Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, President Obama in Israel, bank trouble in Cyprus, gun violence and gun talk at home, and the anniversary of a war. On his first presidential visit to Israel, President Obama argued for peace with the Palestinians and vowed American support to Israelis.
So long as there is a United States of America, atem lo lavad. You are not alone.
Colorado State Prisons Chief Tom Clements gunned down at the front door of his home Tuesday night, just a day before Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper signed a big package of gun control measures. The governor remembered him.
Tom Clements dedicated his life to being a public servant, to making our state better, to making the world a better place, and he is going to be deeply, deeply missed.
And the Iraq War 10 years on this week in the United States, talk and reflection. In Iraq, on the anniversary of shock and awe, a string of car bombs, 65 dead. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Peter Beinart of The Daily Beast, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? What do you hear from the president in Israel? What do you see coming on guns, on Cyprus, on Syria? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us now from New York is Peter Beinart, senior political writer for The Daily Beast, editor of OpenZion.com, associate professor of journalism and political science at City University of New York, author of The Crisis of Zionism. Peter Beinart, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you.
Also with us from Washington is Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Karen, welcome back to you as well. Great to have you.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Peter, and Karen.
Karen, let's go first to President Obama's agenda for this big Israel visit, his first visit there as president, not coming until early now in his second term. What was the agenda? How's it look to you as he, what I'm hearing, has been driving through a sandstorm too thick to fly to Jordan?
Well, I think there has been a bit of a reset in the relationship. He goes there at a very different context. The relationship, particularly with Bibi Netanyahu, has been quite strained, and there's a lot of disappointment among Palestinians about how little has been achieved. One thing that really struck me, though, about the speech was that it was essentially an appeal to the Israeli public that, you know, you have an interest in this becoming a more stable region of the world, and you are going to have to pressure your leaders. It was, he was not promising to sort of get in the middle and start up another effort at peace. He was essentially trying to rally political support. In some ways, it was almost a mirror image of Netanyahu going in front of our Congress.
It was kind of a be the change you seek, or be the change I seek message to those students. They responded pretty vociferously. Let's hear a couple pieces of this. On his last day in Israel, the president visited, spoke at Yad Vashem Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem. Here he is first there.
We could come here 1,000 times, and each time our hearts would break. For here we see the depravity to which man can sink, the barbarism that unfolds when we begin to see our fellow human beings as somehow less than us.
The barbarism that unfolds when we begin to see our fellow human beings as somehow less than us at the Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem. And then, of course, as Karen, you allude to the speech to Israeli students in Jerusalem on Thursday, saying that peace in the region was the only way to assure the safety of Israel.
Given the march of technology, the only way to truly protect the Israeli people over the long term is through the absence of war, because no wall is high enough and no Iron Dome is strong enough or perfect enough to stop every enemy that is intent on doing so from inflicting harm.
Peter Beinart, you've watched this back and forth between the United States, President Obama, and Israel for a long time. What do you see in this chapter of the relationship in this visit from this president, Peter?
Well, I think in policy terms, I think the most practical result of the trip was for the president to buy himself time on Iran. The president seems to have gotten Benjamin Netanyahu to essentially agree that there is a year-long window in which the United States could now move towards trying to make some kind of diplomatic deal with Iran. So I think that was probably, in policy terms, Obama's single biggest achievement. I think Karen's exactly right. The speaking to Israeli young people takes place in a very interesting context. Israeli politics in the last couple of years has been dominated by domestic issues. It's almost as if the Palestinians don't exist. There were huge social protests in Israel 2 summers ago, but they were entirely about domestic issues. And then in this recent election campaign, the Palestinian question was very much on the back burner. So I think, and you have an Israeli government that I think, as currently constituted, would be unable to make really dramatic moves on the peace process. So in a way, what I think Obama is doing is reaching out to young Israelis and saying to them, you have to take ownership over this issue again. You have to change the political reality in Israel. Otherwise, Israel's going to be in a lot of trouble.
Jack, what did you make of the moral argument that the president delivered to those students and the students' response, Jack?
Well, you know, he comes to a country that where only 1 in 10 have a favorable opinion of him. And to judge by those students, maybe that will change. I was struck by the 2 exercises of empathy that he engaged in. One, toward the Israelis. He said, when I consider Israel's security, I think about children like Osha Tweeto, whom I met in Sderot, children the same age as my own daughters who went to bed at night fearful that a rocket would land in their bedroom. Empathy toward the Israelis. And then he turns and he says, but put yourself in the shoes of the Palestinians. Look at the world through their eyes. It's not fair that a Palestinian child cannot grow up in a state of her own. It's not fair that her parents are harassed. It's not fair that they can't farm their own lands. A powerful appeal to what Lincoln called and what the president often paraphrased, the better angels of Israeli nature.
Peter, does that have an impact in Israel? If only 1 in 10 see President Obama favorably, if you buy that poll number, I don't know, but does it have an appeal when he comes with this is a familiar kind and an often powerful kind of moral argument from the American president, this time in an Israeli context? What about the impact of it, Peter?
Well, the theory is that the president had less leverage over Benjamin Netanyahu last time around during his fight on the settlements and his fight on the 1967 Lines speech because he was not popular in Israel. And therefore, it made it easier for Netanyahu to resist his pressure. There probably is some truth in the fact that if Obama – I don't think Obama was ever really at 10% in Israel. Remember, 20% of Israel's own population of citizens are Palestinians themselves. But it's probably Obama boosting his ratings in Israel may give him a little more leverage over Netanyahu the next time they have some kind of conflict over the question of moving towards a Palestinian state. But the real question now is, if Obama has built himself a little bit of political credibility with this trip by reaching out to Israelis in very powerful symbolic ways, will he use it? Because if he really does try to use it to restart a serious move towards a viable Palestinian state, that very likely will put him in conflict again with Benjamin Netanyahu, because almost everything we know about Benjamin Netanyahu and about some elements in this coalition government of his suggest that they really don't support the kind of Palestinian state that Bill Clinton proposed in 2000 and that Ehud Olmert, Netanyahu's predecessor, promised in 2008.
Let me bring our listeners in right here. Elaine in Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Elaine. You're on the air. Hello. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. First of all, I want to thank the president for what he is doing, you know, appealing to people's better natures. But our government seems to ignore all the illegal things that Israel does. So, for example, having nuclear weapons, quite a lot of them, I think 200 or so, putting up the wall, segregating people, having all those checkpoints that make life so difficult for the Palestinians, having separate roads for them that are not even maintained, demolishing their houses, creating more and more settlements on Palestinian land. And it seems like no matter what Israel does, the United States just unilaterally supports them. I mean,
so what should he do? It's an ally, Elaine. What should he do?
He should say, you know, the Palestinians have an equal right to live in a situation that is compatible with just normal life. And he should say to the Israelis, if they're not willing to stop persecuting the Palestinians, then we're going to withhold foreign aid. We give them so much of our foreign aid, and most of it goes to their military.
Elaine, I appreciate your call. Our time is short before the break. Karen Tumulty, what kind of follow-up do you expect? We'll look at Iran and more, but what kind of follow-up, if any, do you expect on the Israeli-Palestinian front? Talks, I think Secretary of State John Kerry is coming in there. Is there a material policy follow-on planned here?
Well, actually, we saw the president moving the opposite direction from the way that Elaine would like to see him go, in that he did not call for a freeze on settlements as a precondition to negotiations. Having done that a few years back and having seen it, you know, sort of just a real backlash on that. So basically, I think, if anything, the direction with regard to the thing she would like to see is the opposite.
Meaning you don't see him preparing to invest in a reignition of peace talks?
Well, I think he would like to sort of lay the groundwork for everybody to get there, but without any preconditions.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. President Obama in Israel. Assault weapon ban off the table for now. Bank chaos in Cyprus, Syria, and chemical weapons. Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post, is here. Peter Beinart, senior political writer at The Daily Beast, joins us, author of The Crisis of Zionism. Jack Beatty's here. Peter Beinart, you say the president, in policy terms, has bought himself maybe a year on Iran and the possibility of action or some kind of resolution there. He also talked very specifically about Syria while he was in Israel in the week when all sides in that civil conflict there, war, accused the other of using chemical weapons. In his speech, the president said in Jerusalem, the president said chemical weapons, any use or handing off of them would be a red line for the U.S.
I've made it clear to Bashar al-Assad and all who follow his orders, we will not tolerate the use of chemical weapons against the Syrian people or the transfer of those weapons to terrorists. The world is watching. We will hold you accountable.
Peter, how acute is the concern there?
Well, the concern is much greater than chemical weapons. I mean, I appreciate the horror of chemical weapons, but what's happening in Syria and has been happening now for more than a year is a horror which goes far beyond chemical weapons. And I think that the Obama administration, this has been so far one of the Obama administration's greatest foreign policy failures. Now, to be fair, it was not an easy situation. It's not an easy situation, but it seems that what we have lost our control of our ability, so far at least, to shape the anti-Assad movement in Syria. It's become more fragmented. It's become more radical. And by not intervening earlier and trying more aggressively, perhaps with by sending weapons, to shape the nature of the opposition to Assad, we are now in a terrible, terrible situation where we have a hideous dictator who has done terrible things to his people, but an opposition that parts of which at least also look very frightening to Israel and frightening to the world.
Karen, do you see the president tiptoeing toward action with the talk about, you know, we will do something if chemical weapons are used or seem to be in transit? I mean, the bigger picture of suffering there has not moved him on Syria. Is he signaling that we may be nearer to something because of this particular threat?
Well, at the moment, it doesn't appear that there's anything to really substantiate that threat. The president himself said that that there was no intelligence to substantiate the government's accusation that the rebels had used chemical weapons. The most recent reports suggest that there's also not any evidence, particularly in looking at, you know, hospital photos of some of these victims, that the government did either. So I honestly don't know what to make of these reports this week, except that, you know, again, it looks as though people are not finding any kind of independent evidence to substantiate them at this point.
I want to bring it home to guns and the gun debate here. But, Jack, last word on this trip, long awaited, didn't happen in his first term. Here it is. What's your bottom line? Is there motion here or just argumentation, a standstill? What?
Well, there was some bonhomie with the prime minister. Someone called this. Yeah, sort of. Someone called it Operation Desert Schmooze. And that was good. It's good that they have some sort of a relationship. You know, you asked Tom earlier, what do you wish he had said privately to the prime minister? And I really hope he said privately, this country cannot have a war in the Middle East. That's just not on for us.
Meaning nowhere, not Iran, not Syria,
and that Israel has to understand that our interests do not overlap necessarily completely. And and it's a very tricky thing to say, we have your back, but don't dare attack, because we're not under the missiles. But I really hope that he has cautioned the Israeli leader that this country has turned the page. We're leaving that area. Our energy future is even going to be independent. Where the wars are stopping. The people want us home. We can't have another war.
Peter, can you picture that message implicitly or explicitly having been left by the president in Israel?
Well, but the tricky thing, of course, is the president has now again and again said that containment and deterrence, which were our policies during the Cold War against such nice guys as Stalin and Mao, who had much larger nuclear arsenals than Iran is ever going to get, is not a possibility. I think it's actually not an intellectually very convincing argument, but that's the one he's made again and again unmistakably. So he's put himself in a situation in which if he can't get a diplomatic deal, and assuming the Iranians do want to go all the way to weaponizing a nuclear weapon, then he's going to have backed himself into a corner. And whatever he said to Benjamin Netanyahu privately, he said that publicly too many times to get out of it.
Let's bring it back home on guns. This week, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid said that the assault weapons ban would not be in the base gun control bill. It just weren't enough votes to have an assault ban's weapon in the Senate bill. Here he is.
Right now, her amendment, using the most optimistic numbers, has less than 40 votes. That's not 60. I have to get something on the floor so we can have votes on that issue and the other issues that I've talked about.
And here's Dianne Feinstein responding on CNN's The Situation Room.
The American people have said in every single public poll that they support this kind of legislation. It's aimed to protect children, to protect schools and malls. It's aimed to dry up the supply of these over time. And it came out on a 10-8 vote of the Judiciary Committee. Not to give me a vote on this would be a major betrayal of trust in my as I would see it.
Karen Tumley with The Washington Post. Harry Reid says she'll have her vote on an amendment, not on assault weapons, in the base bill. But what do you see actually coming out of this Senate, Republicans and Democrats, before the dust settles here?
I think you're going to see a bill that has some language on background checks, which is something, an aspect of gun control that there is a lot of agreement on.
Language. Does that mean universal background checks or something less?
Again, we're going to have to see what happens on the Senate floor, because when Harry Reid opens it up for amendments like the assault weapons ban, that also means that it will be opened up to amendments from the other side. Harry Reid is looking at, you know, says some very practical considerations here, one of which is the electoral map for 2014 and a number of seats that are now held for the by Democrats in states like West Virginia, Arkansas, Alaska are going to be coming up for election. And I think that, you know, that has essentially doomed any hope there was for Democrats to vote for anything terribly aggressive. But at the same time, there is a very strong demand for this language, including by the Democratic base, which is why even as Harry Reid was announcing this, you saw Vice President Joe Biden up in New York with Mayor Bloomberg talking about continuing to press for something that essentially Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, says is doomed in the Senate.
I'm interested in the match or mismatch between public sentiment and what we see possibly coming out of Congress. Let's hear from our listeners. Steve in Nashville, Tennessee. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You know, listening and hearing these conversations, it's like beating a dead horse. You know, the whole assault weapons ban, there's just a total lack of common sense with Congress. They're putting their own agendas before the agenda of the country. The entire country wants this. The majority of the country wants this, I should say. And there's just no common sense in trying to pass these laws. And until they put their agendas aside, I mean, they don't care about the country. They just care about their own careers and their own money that's being made and the money of the gun makers and the gun. It's all a big farce.
Steve, what about people who say common sense says the assault weapons ban wouldn't make much difference? There are a zillion of them out there already. They're not used in most of the gun killings in this country. What about that argument?
That argument doesn't hold. I mean, you look at other countries like Australia who went ahead and took all their assault weapons away.
Bought them all back.
They took action. There's no action here. It is all Congress is playing a game with us, and we're all the pawns in the game. And I think people need to take more action and get out in the streets and be more radical about this in order to get something to be done, because they're not doing anything.
Steve, we've got it loud and clear. Let me get one more, if I may, right here from Baltimore. Phil, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I love your show, but I was just, I'm a liberal center-left person who doesn't own guns, but I don't agree with the assault weapon ban, because it just seems like once it goes through the Congress, it'll probably have way too many loopholes and easy ways to get around it. And so I was wondering why they don't go after, like, liability for manufacturers, sellers, buyers, and companies that do background checks, you know, hold them responsible if they don't do a good job or if they lose their guns or their guns end up in the wrong hands. Because it seems like if you put a monetary incentive behind it where they can lose money for their weapons, they'll be much more efficient in stopping gun violence than any kind of regulation that is bound to have tons of loopholes.
Yeah, Phil, let us pick that one up right there. That's interesting. Peter Beinart, if I recall correctly here, this is exactly the kind of liability that the NRA pushed very, very hard against, lobbied hard against for many years, and that I think during the George W. Bush administration, the Supreme Court weighed in here at last. I think those companies are now, what is it, by legislation or by court decision, exempt from that kind of liability. Am I wrong, Peter?
You may well be right about that, but I think that eventually, there's going to if Congress turns out to be unable to respond to the will of the American people on this, I think that people are going to look for other avenues. And it may indeed be that through the courts, with the model of what was done to cigarettes, maybe in fact the model. I think it's important to understand how farcically undemocratic what's happening in the Senate is. First of all, the Senate massively overrepresents the interests of small rural states. The idea that Nevada has as much power in the Senate as does California, so is a kind of antiquated element of our political system.
But that is by founders' design from the get-go, on purpose.
That's right. But it's based on the idea that Congress represents states rather than represents individuals. And when you add to that this virtual filibuster, not a real filibuster, mm-hmm. but this virtual, almost permanent filibuster that we have, then you can imagine essentially 41 small state senators representing a very small fraction of the American people, preventing what, as Dianne Feinstein rightly said, is the overwhelming will of most Americans. And I think this is – we are going to – at the beginning of this gun control fight, it is going to go on for many, many years. And I think people are going to look for some avenues to go around what is, a blatantly undemocratic exercise of power in the Senate.
Let's go to New Orleans. And Brett, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. So a lot of them talked about the assault rifle ban, which I agree with that. The assault rifle is not really the issue at hand, and I think a lot of people are really talking about it because they fear this image of the lone gunman standing in the hallway with the rifle. I think it's just such a frightening image, but it's not really the problem. I think you look at the majority of murders in the U.S., look at the problems with gun control, it comes down to handguns, especially in urban environments. I'm a liberal from a major city, and I would still sit here and say the gun ban is not good in its current form and doesn't address the major issue.
So what do you want?
A lot of it is. I think the two big things we're not looking at is the media gives them a lot of limelight. When we look at these gunmen, it gives them this blaze of glory thing, which I think is a psychologically powerful component and a motivator.
Hard to ignore them when they kill 20 children in how many minutes?
Of course. So I'm not saying we can ignore it, but the whole point but the thing is, like, there's almost – it puts them up on I can't even think of the term for a pedestal, obviously.
Yep.
You're not honoring them.
Yep.
But the other component being that we're also ignoring – mental health in America. I think that's been a long-standing problem we've had here. And addressing, we always say, well, the signs are there. Well, what are we doing about that? What are we doing to bring people down to a calmer level? And, you know, this comes down to back, you know, because this all ties into background checks and stuff too. Why is it easier for people to circumvent? Why don't we have universal? So I know I'm going a little left and right here, but I feel like it's all related.
Well, we hear that, Brett, and it certainly is. It's a complicated picture. You got so many guns out there. You've got real mental health issues. You've got background checks that are so widely skirted, something like 40% of sales. Jack Beatty, you hear Peter Beinart saying this just isn't democratic, small d, what's unfolding here, and eventually something else will happen. But really, I mean, the interests here are deeply invested, and there is a set of gun owners who simply do not want to let go.
And they have a powerful lobby group. However, something may be changing in this long game, and I think Peter is right about that. It is a long game. Mayor Bloomberg, for example, he intervened in a special election, I think it was just last month, in Illinois, and basically defeated with a blizzard of ads, a pro-gun rights candidate, and elected someone pledged to the president's program. And he's got deep pockets, and he warned yesterday about, he says, you know, Congress just has to get some courage. Well, maybe with his money, they can start to have an incentive to get some courage. The trouble is, of course, that there are two publics. There is the public in the vast public opinion, and then there's the red state public, which is very confused, and that is to say what they think is, we just don't have a read on it. But because the states are so small, it's very possible that opinion there is susceptible to NRA appeal, and that is just a huge problem. The president hoped that there would be a rising, that people would get out in the streets, that even in the red states they'd say enough is enough. Apparently that didn't happen this time. It may the next, and perhaps Mayor Bloomberg can help bring that about.
Karen Tumulty, do you see a fundamental reordering of the calculus here between, you know, the death toll and Bloomberg maybe and President Obama maybe, or not?
Well, when I hear people talk about the NRA and their money, it ignores what I think is even more powerful, which is the cultural connection that the NRA has in some parts of the country. So I just I may well be wrong here, but I don't think Mayor Bloomberg's money is going to mean a lot in West Virginia or Arkansas or some of these places. There is just the NRA has been part of the culture in parts of the country for decades, and they also have instilled, I think, a fear on the part of a lot of gun owners that essentially the government is, you know, anything that happens is a pretext for the government to come in and grab your guns, which is why I was in South Carolina this week, and people there were telling me that guns are absolutely disappearing from the shelves of the gun stores.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, let the late night wars begin again. A flood of reports this week that Jimmy Fallon will replace Jay Leno on The Tonight Show, maybe next year. Here's Fallon.
Before we get started, I have to talk about the rumors that came out today, which says that I'll be moving up to 11:30, or as my parents call it, still too late.
Still too late. On Wednesday, outside Houston, Texas, a freak hailstorm pummeled the town of Brookshire. Resident Michelle Clark told KPRC Local 2 Houston she was one of the many to wake in the middle of the night to a big bang.
He said, kapooya, kapooya. And your boy, that hail just came in. I looked out my door, it started hitting me in my head. I took out running, ran to my restroom, and then I called my mama to see was she all right.
When the hail is big, it's big. And 7 Marines tragically killed this week in a training accident with mortar fire in Nevada. Speaking to ABC News, Melissa Vanderwerk, whose son, Corporal Mason Vanderwerk, was one of the 7, was overcome with grief.
He was truly my best friend. Not only my son, but my best friend and my hero. And he could never be replaced.
7 there, 4,000 and more in Iraq over the years of that war, and a lot of remembrance of that this week on the 10th anniversary of the American invasion of Iraq. We're looking at a week in the news with Peter Beinart of the Daily Beast, Karen Tumulty of the Washington Post, and Jack Beatty. I want to look at Cyprus for a moment, just because it is the rare week when Cyprus has the world's attention, but it certainly did this week. First, the call for a kind of across-the-board tax on bank accounts there, 6 to 10%, depending on the size of the account, to help bail out Cyprus's banks, which are in real trouble. The EU putting the pressure on here, the European Central Bank. Cyprus Parliament saying, no, we're not going to do it. People looking at Russia, lots of big Russian money in Cyprus. It's sort of their Cayman Islands. Here's the Russian Prime Minister, Dmitry Medvedev, saying that the financial problems in Cyprus had not been handled properly, interpreted here by the Russian news channel RT.
So far, the EU, together with the Cyprus Parliament, have unfortunately acted like a bull in a china shop. I think all possible mistakes which could have been made in this situation have been made.
Some suggestion that Europe would have been happy for Russian oligarchs to be to take part, a big part of the haircut there, to help bail Cyprus out. So far, that's not happening. Peter Beinart, there's a deadline on Monday for them to come up with something. This is one of those kind of events that people say could launch a contagion. What is it? The minister in charge of all this in Cyprus, his name, in if it's Greek, it actually means panic. What do you see happening here, Peter?
Well, it seems like at the end of the day, Cyprus is likely to have to back down and swallow a kind of a deal. There have been some other kind of proposals that they've been floating today, but it seems like they're going to have to accept some kind of deal which is going to be punishing for the people of Cyprus, because it doesn't seem like there's anyone else that's going to offer them this money. But I think the EU is going to have to also come forward with a significant bailout, because this has been one of the kind of fundamental realities of the world economic situation of the past few years, is this fear that relatively smaller countries in Europe could set off a contagion in Europe that could spread throughout even to the United States. And I think it's been one of the things that's been causing a lot of uncertainty even about the economic recovery here. So I think at the end of the day, it seems to me unlikely that some kind of deal won't get done, but it does underscore the fundamental weakness that seems to still exist in Europe economically, and that I think is slowing down the whole global economy in a situation where China and the U.S. are doing better, but Europe, as the kind of third leg of this international economic stool, really seems to be having a lot of problems.
Karen Tumulty, this week you've got Cyprus in trouble, people worried about that contagion spreading, some stock markets certainly rumbling this week in response to that. At the same time, J.P. Morgan's famous London whale trade in the spotlight this week, and people saying, look, after all these years after the banking collapse, we still globally really haven't come in and really tightened up the ship, and we remain vulnerable. Are you hearing that chatter, that feeling, that vulnerability, Karen?
Well, certainly it is the big kind of X factor in our own recovery, is that even as, you know, so many things in the United States feel like they are beginning to get back on track, our vulnerability to anything, you know, any sort of blip in things overseas is, you know, could throw all that completely off track.
Jack, Europe, with Germany at the heart of it, hardly seems too eager to really come in and do something big for Cyprus here. And yet, that risk of EU really tripping up, not behind us.
Yes, that interdependence that can be a sort of chain of fatality. You know, this is an economy the size of Vermont's. And I was struck by an analysis that Andrew Ross Sorkin did this week. And he said, all right, their depositors are being asked to pay 10% of their holdings. But he points out that if an investment of 100,000 euros 5 years ago at 5% interest, which is what those banks were paying, would have left, even with the 10% haircut, the average Cypriot 12,000 euros ahead. Whereas over in the U.S., $100,000 in a U.S. bank for 5 years would only get you $105,000. So even with the 10% haircut, they would be ahead. So I'm sorry.
Oh, the problem, of course, though, is money can move. It really would undermine your banking system if all of a sudden depositors began to realize that, you know, people could just come in, the government could come in at any moment and just grab some of your money. It is hard to imagine that this money wouldn't move, especially given the fact that a lot of this is not the money of Cypriots. It's basically the money of Russian gangsters.
Yeah, but, I mean, the argument made there is, look, they've been making out like gangsters at a 4% interest rate in these times for many years. years here. So, okay, boys, your Cayman Islands game is, you know, the gig is up. It's time to pay the piper. But who knows what's going to happen here? Russia watching closely there. Bonds may be issued this weekend on oil and gas and gold. We'll see what comes down the pike. Let's get a call from Bob in Saratoga Springs, New York. Bob, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Just an observation on the Iraq war. I remember news reports coming from Washington in the fall of 2002 about how excited everyone was about the prospect of going to war. And it reminded me of the beginning of Gone with the Wind, where all the Southerners at the Wilkes picnic are equally excited about this forthcoming war with the Yankees.
The glorious forthcoming war. And then?
And then disaster on both accounts.
that interesting Gone with the Wind analogy there. Peter Beinart, lots of talk and reflection on the Iraq war this week. Many people looking back on their own thoughts then and now. No doubt, including you. I mean, you were one of those who endorsed it and famously has rethought in public. Were you in a Gone with the Wind bubble or something else then, Peter? And what about now? How do you look on it at 10?
Yeah, you know, I wrote two books trying to wrestle with why it was that I had ended up supporting the Iraq war. And I think, speaking for myself, but I think also a lot of people that I knew, I think it was the product in some ways of being of a period in the watching a period in the 1990s and in the early 2000s in which there had been a lot of American military success, and also this vast wave of a spreading of democracy around the world, and also a kind of overcoming of the budget surplus, which created a hubris that I think I was susceptible to about what you could reasonably expect the United States military to be able to accomplish. And I think that was particularly true for those of us who were really shaped by the experiences of the Gulf War and Bosnia and Kosovo, where there was disaster predicted, and in fact America turned out to triumph and then maybe even do something good. I think the result has been fundamentally now that whether the American character has changed or not, simply America does not have the resources to do anything like Iraq anymore. We don't have the money. We don't. The public, as Jack Beatty referenced in regards to Iran, the public is tired of war. The public is highly cognizant of the fact that we have enormous challenges here at home if we're going to maintain our standard of living and our position in the world. And so I think we are in a kind of a post-hubris period. And I think that the challenge for many years in the United States is going to be able to rebuild our domestic strength and to recognize that that is at the core, ultimately at the core of our international influence, not how many troops we can deploy in far-flung countries.
Karen, what about it? The thinking and the resources. As we look back 10 years on the launch of that war and now look forward at potential conflict with Iran, are the resources there to do that? For all the talk about it, is there the heart, the thinking to do it in Washington?
Well, it's not just Iraq. It's the fact that Afghanistan turned out, which people, I think, even were thinking, including Barack Obama, were almost thinking of at the time as the good war, you know, where we should be going. And that has turned out to be a lot harder to get out of than it was to get into.
We're still not out.
Exactly. And so there is just a real fatigue on the part of the American people. And you know, it may be that in the not too distant future, it becomes a stain on our nation that we didn't intervene in Syria. But right now, there is just simply not the will.
Jack Beatty, 10 years ago, you and I were on the air here talking about Iraq, 10 years and more. And talking about Iraq, saying, think twice, to the point that we were sort of taken to task by newspaper columnists, you know, enough already about this impending war. Let's just do it. Well, we did. The country did. And we've seen the years since. What have you been thinking in this week, 10 years on, Jack?
Well, you know, there were sort of non-repeatable phenomena there. I think the people around President Bush, you're never going to see a crew like that again. And it may well be that neoconservative will take on the aura of isolationist in future years, something you just can't have around policy. And of course, there were, you know, we'll only knock over the Iran's major opponent in the Middle East once. You only do that once.
Yeah.
But there are repeatable things, too, and that's what worries me. And one of them is the susceptibility of our elites to sort of groupthink. You know, Hal Rosenberg famously spoke of the herd of independent minds. And that was displayed really, notably throughout the build-up to the Iraq War, where very thoughtful people whom others looked to sort of mint the ideas and to put in language the inchoate sentiments of people. This group got it wrong consistently, and why they did, I think Peter had a very lucid comment there about why he felt that way, but others for different reasons. But that remains true, you see. And I remember reading something that a leader of the Council on Foreign Relations said. He said, "I have to be for this war because if I'm not, people will think I'm a liberal peacenik." Well, there is a lot of that. That's still around, that kind of pressure on opinion leaders. And then thirdly, you know, we can't take the people, us, off the hook. Tocqueville drew attention to the group-mindedness of Americans. We remain in some, for all our differences, there are areas where we just have a kind of, you know, okay, we'll all do this together. And it doesn't serve us very well.
And in we went, anyway, with a lot of heads up, and as Peter Beinart says, maybe no small amount of hubris. Adaz is calling from Nashville. Adaz, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I just wanted to say about the Iraqi war. I think it was a positive thing. I'm actually an American Kurd.
Yes.
My parents are from Kurdistan, and it has actually helped the Kurdish people of northern Iraq. It has opened up democracy. It has opened up funds through every direction. The way I look at it is it's like Germany. It took them over 10 years just to resettle after Hitler. I know money-wise it's been draining America. Yes, war is, and Eisenhower talked about the military complex. It's a needed thing, but we need to make it more efficient, more organized.
Adaz, we've got it. Our time is short, but as an American Kurd, looking at the Kurds' long-suffering under Saddam Hussein, you say, good, and thank you. Peanut butter, what about the upsides here? Do they get lost in the bigger sense of, oh, my gosh, that was way too much money and blood? Do they stand up to the other side of the ledger, Peter?
Well, I think it's important to remember that much of the Kurdish area was already de facto autonomous even before we went in to overthrow Saddam. Now, it's true that independence has become more fully realized now. But there, as I understand it, there's also still great dangers in places like Kirkuk that there could be spillover in violence between Kurds and Iraqis. So there were Iraqis, Kurds and others like Kanan Makia, who had suffered enormously under Saddam, who made a moral case for military action, one that had a big influence on me. And I understand where those people are coming from. But it's also important to remember that a huge number of Iraqis have died. And although it's a good thing that Saddam Hussein is not there, that there is enormous, enormous suffering that has been inflicted on the Iraqi people as a result of this war. And I think we have to keep that in mind as well.
I want to turn to the GOP. Big report out this week on what went wrong in November. Here was on Monday at the National Press Center, Republican National Committee Chair Reince Priebus talking about the GOP's post-mortem report on why Republicans lost in November.
There's no one reason we lost. Our message was weak. Our ground game was insufficient. We weren't inclusive. We were behind in both data and digital. And our primary and debate process needed improvement. So there's no one solution. There's a long list of them.
From the head of the GOP, and right behind that, Rand Paul talking about softening up on immigration, legal status for those who came illegally to this country. Perhaps, Karen, do you see a big renovation underway in the GOP? Just a rebranding? Both?
Well, I think the most stinging criticism in that report, and it was a pretty rough-edged report, was basically that the party has gone into a cul-de-sac, that it is only it's only talking to itself. It's not reaching out. And it did make some vague recommendations for things like comprehensive immigration reform. But I think everyone agrees that even if they snazz up their technology and get their primaries working right and move up their convention and all that stuff, they've still got a problem with some of their ideas. And that was what was significant. To hear Rand Paul, although he did not actually use the word citizenship, but he was implying that that party's got to move there on immigration. And that's just one of the issues that I think they are going to really have to do a lot of soul searching on.
Peter, if the GOP goes in all the directions that Reince Priebus described right there, is it still the GOP?
the Republican Party has got to stop thinking about Ronald Reagan as the only model. That's the fundamental shift. Many of the most important lessons for the Republicans are not from Ronald Reagan. They are from people like Dwight Eisenhower and Richard Nixon. The Republican Party to compete again in the United States is going to have to recognize, is going to have to talk about income inequality. It's going to have to recognize that a rising tide is not lifting all boats, and is going to have to really think hard about how it helps working class Americans. Only that, I think, will fundamentally bring the Republicans back to power.
Jack, we've got 10 seconds. Is the heat high enough in the kitchen to make that new dish come out from the Republican, gang?
Well, they've lost 5 out of 6 the last presidential elections, and the Democrats in that time got 26 million more votes. Do they need another defeat to change? Who knows?
Jack, great to have you with us today. Thanks so much for joining us. Karen Tumulty with The Washington Post, Peter Beinart with The Daily Beast. Thanks to you all. This is On Point.